This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This week on Radio EcoShock, we're going to the end of the Earth. It's a feature-length interview about new science that shows Antarctica is melting. I guarantee you will read headlines and see amazing video news from the science we're discovering this week. Sea levels will rise around the planet for centuries, reshaping the coastlines and civilization. Then we'll finish up with the return of Marjorie Wildcraft with more tips on growing your own groceries. It's all food for thought and action. I'm Alex Smith. The journey begins. There's a lot of action in Antarctica, and that can bring changes all over the world. Here to discuss recent science is Dr. Roland C. Warner. He is a researcher with the Antarctic Climate and Ecosystems Cooperative Research Center at the University of Tasmania. Tasmania is the closest Australian state to Antarctica. Dr. Warner, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. Great to be with you.
Well, thank you for joining us for an update on this frozen world at the South Pole. First of all, what parts of Australia are closest to Antarctica, and what claims does your country have on that continent?
Okay, well, I'm here in Tasmania. This is an island state of Australia, south of the Australian mainland, and while Antarctica is still some distance away to our south, there are only a few small islands in the middle of the Southern Ocean between Australia and Antarctica. However, as you alluded, Australia does have a territorial claim to a large piece of the Antarctic, about 42% of it, to be precise. Now, various countries established these claims in the age of heroic exploration, you know, putting out flags and claiming things in the name of typically your monarch or your state was the done thing in those days. And these claims exist, and some of them actually tend to overlap, particularly around the most accessible parts of Antarctica, in that finger of the Antarctic Peninsula that points up to South America. And one big sector isn't actually claimed by anyone at all. But these claims are all on ice, if you will, under the Antarctic Treaty, which was established in the 1950s. And it's that treaty that governs how people behave in Antarctica these days, whether they have claims to particular pieces of turf or ice or not.
And have you been there?
Yes, I've been to Antarctica for three summer seasons with a Australian, US, British, French collaborative project. It's imaginatively called ICECAP. This is a bit of a mouthful. It stands for Investigating Cryospheric Evolution Through Collaborative Aerogeophysical Profiling. And what that means is that we have a whole range of instruments on an aircraft. In fact, it's a rejuvenated DC-3, genuine World War II vintage. And we fly for hours and hours out over the ice sheet, measuring many different things that I'm sure we'll discuss today using that aircraft. So I was at Casey Station, which is one of three Australian bases on the continent itself. That's due south of Western Australia. And I've got there in this modern era, either by flying directly there in a jet plane from here in Hobart to a blue ice runway on the ice cap behind the station, or rather more long way round, changing planes at the US station at McMurdo and flying for hours and hours and hours in a ski-equipped Hercules to land at Casey. And on one occasion, I've come home on our icebreaker, which took 7 days instead of 5 hours.
It's a giant place. I mean, it is a real continent. Now, in a shocking bit of news, Antarctica just experienced the two hottest days ever recorded there, namely 63.5 degrees Fahrenheit or 17.5 degrees C, and that was at the Argentinian Esperanza base on the Antarctic Peninsula. I've heard that was warmer than the temperature in Britain on the same day in late March. Is that just a freak occurrence, or do you think Antarctica is warming?
Yeah, I haven't checked. It might have been as warm as the same day here in Hobart. It's not quite an either-or, actually. The Antarctic Peninsula, that finger of Antarctica pointing up towards South America, is an area of Antarctica that shows some of the greatest climate warming of recent years for the whole planet. It's about 5 degrees Celsius warmer over the last 50 years, according to the British Antarctic Survey. So it's consistent with that sort of situation that you're going to keep getting record-breaking maximum temperatures. Of course, one hot day is weather, while the trend in hot days is climate change. It's worth noticing that Esperanza's previous record was only 0.4 degrees Celsius lower. That was back in 1961. And it was even later in the year. It was a month later. It was in April. Certainly Antarctica is warming. And so one has to expect hotter days. So not a freak occurrence.
All right. Well, let's turn to a new scientific paper you were directly involved in. The title is Ocean Access to a Cavity Beneath Totten Glacier in East Antarctica. We need to frame that a bit, obviously. Where is the Totten Glacier and how big is it?
Yes, certainly. The Totten Glacier is the largest glacier in East Antarctica. We tend to split Antarctica up by which of the world's hemispheres we're looking at, since after all, in Antarctica, everything is sort of north. And so East Antarctica is the part sweeping between the Greenwich Meridian and the dateline below Africa and Australia. So the Totten Glacier is, in fact, on almost exactly the opposite side of Antarctica to Esperanza. We're looking at about 116 east longitude, so almost directly below the city of Perth, the capital city of Western Australia. And as I said, it's a very large glacier. It drains 540,000 square kilometres of East Antarctica. Here we like to think of that as being more than twice the size of the Australian state of Victoria. For a North American audience, it might be more helpful to say that's somewhat more than twice the area of all the Great Lakes put together.
And that's big. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, and so just to fill out the rest of the story, there's 70 billion tons of ice flows out of that glacier every year. That's amazingly about the flow rate of Niagara Falls, but obviously it's moving slowly, but on a very grand scale.
Is that the amount that actually reaches the sea every year?
Yep, that's what that's the amount of ice that you can collect in 500,000 square kilometres. I should say that the ice shelf is more than 30 kilometres wide at the front, so considerably bigger span than the Niagara Falls, and it's 200 metres thick there. So there's a lot of ice on the move.
Well, you've hit something that's a little confusing to some of us. We have sea ice, which doesn't directly add to sea level rise. We have melting from land ice, like Greenland, which does add to the sea level rise. And then in the Arctic, there's only a couple of small ice shelves left attached to Canadian polar islands. But in Antarctica, it seems confusing. Could you just give us a quick update on the relationship between sea ice, ice shelves, and land-based glaciers?
Yeah, this is certainly something which confuses a lot of people. Yes, the only ice turning to water or flowing into the sea that's going to affect sea level rise is obviously ice that's currently not floating on the ocean, because courtesy of dear old Archimedes, we actually know that the ice that's floating on the ocean, when it melts, will simply fill in the volume it was previously displacing. So that's not to say that the melting of things like ice shelves, which is glacial ice that's floating on the ocean, that's not to say that it won't have impacts on the Earth system, because it's certainly going to freshen the top layers of the ocean. But in terms of sea level rise, it's grounded ice like Greenland and like the little ice caps that still remain in the Canadian Arctic and mountain glaciers around the world, and the sleeping giant in the west, which perhaps is not sleeping, Antarctica. That's where sea level is going to come from. I would like to sort out the sea ice story as well, though. The thing about sea ice is this is the ocean surface freezing, and it's around Antarctica and in the Arctic. It's one of the big seasonal changes in the Earth's climate system. Around Antarctica in the wintertime, the area where the ocean surface is predominantly covered by ice that's been frozen out of the ocean itself, that almost doubles the size of that big white patch down at the bottom of the globe. And when that sea ice is forming, the sea ice itself is relatively fresh, and the salt water underneath it becomes much saltier. And while it's a different story to the one we want to tell today, that's actually what drives a lot of the deep global ocean circulation, so that things that happen with sea ice around Antarctica will affect the deep, what's called the overturning circulation of the whole planet. So the progression of ice shelves and the ice sheet is also an interesting one. The melting away or the changes in ice shelves don't directly affect sea level rise, as I said, but the ice shelves are in some sense the gatekeepers, particularly for Antarctica, in terms of the rate at which ice flows from the grounded ice sheet into the ocean. And we believe that, in fact, changes in the ice shelves are going to be the major drivers in changing the dynamics of the whole ice sheet. And so they do play a big role in future sea level.
It's been compared to pulling the cork out of a bottle.
Yes, or you can think of it as a keystone in an arch. Basically, you have a big ice shelf. In Antarctica, the biggest ones are very firmly settled in very large bays that would, in fact, probably be called seas if they weren't full of ice shelf. And the presence of the ice shelf there provides a retarding stress that's holding back ice, which is flowing. Typically, ice flow in Antarctica is concentrated into major, quite fast-moving outlet glaciers or ice streams, and it's quite focused flow, like the top that I was mentioning before, and often it's channeled into these very big ice shelves. And so if you do something to change the ice shelf, you're going to do something to change the whole balance of forces that's restraining the rate at which that ice flows into the ocean.
It seems parts of Antarctica are actually below sea level. Is that correct? And what would that continent look like without the ice cap?
Yes, that's certainly true. Again, that east-west Antarctica dividing line is perhaps a useful one here. For a long time, we've known by probing through to see how thick the ice is and how far down it is to the bedrock underneath. We've known that a lot of the West Antarctic ice sheet is standing on the seafloor, maybe half a mile or more, kilometre or so deep. And that includes actually the summit ridge between ice that flows westwards to the Ross Ice Shelf and ice that flows eastwards towards the Amundsen Sea and around towards South America. So if the ice sheet hadn't developed there, this would just be ocean where one could go sailing. And what's developed in the last few years, partly as a result of the major aerial survey that we've done with the Ice Cap project, is we've better defined that extensive areas of East Antarctica are also sitting on bedrock that's deep below sea level. In this case, that turns out because the ice is even thicker than we thought. In some places, it's 2 miles thick. And in particular, we've been exploring the Aurora Basin, which is a vast area in the catchment of the Totten Glacier. And we've identified deep bedrock channels that connect that deep basin to the coastal zone. And so the Aurora Basin and the so-called Wilkes Subglacial Basin, which is immediately to its east, these are the largest, what we call submarine parts of the East Antarctic ice sheet. If you instantly removed all the ice, West Antarctica would simply become a collection of islands. You could sail from the Pacific to the Atlantic without having to go past Cape Horn. And East Antarctica would have a few major bites out of it, which might even rate as sea.
And so until the new research done by your team, we didn't really understand how warmer waters could undermine this Totten Glacier. How does it work, and how did you do the science to find this out?
Yeah, the way that works is that the crucial question for getting melting of ice shelves and hence changing the flow of the ground of ice behind is to work out, is there warm ocean water nearby? And more importantly, are there pathways by which it can circulate its way up onto the continental shelf? And can it actually get into these cavities underneath the ice shelves? And you can imagine it's hard enough to, you can see how deep the ocean is if you sail up and down with sonar on your ship. But it's very hard to work out what's the geometry of the seafloor underneath maybe 1 or even 2 kilometres of ice. Now, the survey aircraft we use has a radar system that can see right through to the base of the ice, and it can even see a lot of internal structure through the ice as well. We also have some magnetometers to try and figure out what sort of character of rock is actually underlying the ice sheet. Most importantly for this work, we have a very sensitive gravity meter. As we fly along, we measure minute variations in the strength of local gravity, and flying very near the surface and very slowly in an old DC-3, maybe 140 knots, is ideal for that sort of survey. Then you have to sit down and do a lot of detailed work to figure out how those tiny variations in the strength of local gravity can be translated into what depth of ice and water and rock is directly below your flight track. So our radar can't penetrate seawater, so we can only see the bottom of the ice sheet. So we only see the bedrock where the ice is on the ground. But this gravity data allows us to map these inaccessible ocean cavities underneath ice shelves, and indeed to map the sea floor off the coast there, where often sea ice prevents ships from getting in. And so what we've been able to do is to map out the shape of the bedrock beneath this floating terminus of both the Totten Glacier and a neighbouring ice shelf called the Moscow University Ice Shelf. And the most significant finding is that there are some deep water channels that connect the open ocean to the cavity. And this includes a previously completely unknown hydrological pathway, if you like, another channel that increases the prospects that warm water can circulate into this cavity. And maybe if the temperature of the water changes, then the melting, which is already quite extensive, and therefore the dynamics of the system will change.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@eagleshock.org. That's radio@eagleshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Australian scientist Roland C. Warner. Roland, can we expect any measurable sea level rise from the Totten Glacier Complex, say, in this century?
Yes, we can. And we're already seeing some small contribution to sea level rise there. I'm not sure that anybody's totaled it all up, because the ground of ice in the glacier stream that forms the Totten Glacier is actually getting thinner near the coast. In fact, the ice surface there has been in recent years, and have a few years' data, but it's been dropping by maybe a metre and a half per year. So this is, in fact, in East Antarctica, one of the hot spots where there definitely is ice loss. In terms of what will happen in the rest of the century, we now know that it's possible to get warm water in there, and the dynamics of the Totten system says that there's already some considerable melting going on there. We don't really know in detail how future climate might increase that heat supply and what the consequent transmission of that effect to sea level rise would be. But it's certainly in East Antarctica, it's the place to watch. Whether the timescale is centuries or a little bit longer, we don't quite know, but certainly a few people are taking this very seriously as perhaps the part of East Antarctica to watch.
There's been a lot of talk between scientists about the importance of the grounding line. What is that?
Yes, the grounding line, it's probably really more of a zone, is where the glacier ice actually starts to go afloat. As we've just discussed, a lot of Antarctica, the ice is sitting really on the sea floor, and as it flows towards the margin, eventually there comes a point where it's simply going to go afloat. Given the direction of ice flow, it probably would be better if it was called the ungrounding line or the flotation line. It's important because it's the place where suddenly the base of the ice sheet is not protected by being on the ground, and suddenly the possibility of ocean-driven melting commences there. And I should say that it's, again, something that we've only learned in the last two decades, that near these grounding lines, where often the ice is very deep here in the Totten, we're talking about a transition point that's probably a mile below sea level. The melting in the vicinity of these grounding lines is tens of metres a year, maybe 50 metres a year. And given that the water that's doing that melting is still, by any swimmer's standard, very close to freezing, it's likely that this is an extremely sensitive part of the climate system. So that's the first thing that's important about the grounding line. The second thing that's important is that particularly in some configurations of the bedrock, these grounding lines themselves may move. So it's not just a matter of bringing more ice up to a a fixed gate and then having it flow through there and melt away. It's quite possible that the grounding line itself will migrate inland, reducing the size of the grounded ice sheet and transmitting these changes in forces at the margin even further upstream.
Well, sea level rise is the real wild card when we think about impacts of Antarctic melting. I've just gone through a paper by lead author Fernando Paolo titled Volume Loss from Antarctic Ice Shelves is Accelerating. Is it just the ice shelves, or is ice loss from Antarctica increasing and at a faster rate? Do we know?
Yeah, this comes back to the point we were discussing earlier, that these guys have done a great job in trying to improve our understanding about what's happening to ice shelves. Previously, we had quite good measurements with a quite precise laser instrument that was flying in space for a few years, showing that these ice shelves were getting thinner. It's a really hard problem because given that the ice shelf is floating, if you see a half a meter change in the surface height of the floating ice shelf, that means that he's lost 5 meters of ice from below. What they've done here is said, well, that 5-year record is rather short, and so the longest record that's available is actually only about 18 years from some radar satellites that were measuring the height of the ice shelves. And so they've been able to conclude that ice shelves are certainly on the whole getting thinner, so they're losing ice, which is actually slightly freshening the Antarctic coastal ocean. But because they're getting thinner, they're also likely reducing this restraining force that they have on the ice sheet. And in fact, the ice shelves where they see the biggest changes in West Antarctica are in those places where the outlet glaciers have been observed to be speeding up. So it's certainly important, and it's important in terms of exploring what we think is one of the controllers of change in the ice sheet and sea level contributions from the ice sheet itself.
In a comment on that article, one of the scientists, Laurie Padman, expressed there's a lot of uncertainty about what will happen on Antarctica as the world climate changes. In fact, he said, quote, "It is plausible that even if the Earth's average temperature increases, the effect on ocean currents around Antarctica might actually work against Antarctic ice sheet melting." And he goes on to say that past paleo records may not tell us a lot because we're changing the climate so fast compared to what happened in past times. What do you think about all that?
Well, it's true that one has to be careful about, even financial planners tell you past performance is no guarantee of future performance. But we're certainly changing the composition of the atmosphere, and so he's correct that the driver for changing climate is no longer the Milankovitch, the so-called ice age cycle. Mind you, those changes were pretty dramatic in terms of sea level rise 14,000 years ago when the great northern hemisphere ice sheets decayed. But certainly we're forcing the system a lot faster now than any natural forcing that's been applied. I'd be a little surprised if it was actually going to work against ice sheet melting on the whole. The deep ocean is already warming, and you've only got to warm water a little bit for it to carry a lot of heat compared to the way heat can be carried by changes in air temperature. So I think that the change in dynamic response is going to be quite high, and that's a little hard to see that we can avoid conveying that warmth through the ice shelves, and then by weakening the ice shelves, increase the ice discharge from Antarctica. Certainly warmer air temperatures will generate some higher snowfall, but it's not really clear that that can dominate the sort of accelerations of ice flow that we've already seen.
And Laurie Padman also talks about the irony that sea levels around Antarctica and Greenland may actually go down as the glaciers melt. How is that possible?
Yeah, this is quite amazing. It's another one of these obvious with hindsight insights, and it's a pretty recent insight for glaciologists anyway. Any sort of water surface represents our common sense idea of level, since obviously water flows downhill. In fact, the sea surface measured with precision from space shows that that idea of downhill is modulated by all sorts of things like currents and winds and other factors. And in particular, the vast mass of ice on these grounded ice sheets exerts a sufficient gravitational attraction to pull the ocean around them towards them, and this generates an an upslope in the sea surface around the ice sheets. And so locally, if you're losing lots of ice, you know, billions of tons of ice, then that reduces this attraction. And it's a bit of a surprise to one's intuition that, in fact, near ice sheets, this can outweigh the overall effect that you put that lost ice into the global sea level. But, in fact, near the ice sheet, the sea level is going to fall considerably more. And, in fact, there have only been a few idealized computer simulations trying to put this effect into account. And this does provide a little bit of a stabilizer to grounding line retreat if the sea level near your ice sheet or your outlet glacier is falling. I should just say there's a bad news consequence to this local effect, which means that the sea level rises more than you might have expected far away from the ice sheets. And there are some estimates that in North America you might get 25% more than global average sea level rise. So the water all has to go somewhere.
Right. Now, some scientists, including the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, suggest total sea level rise by 2100 may only be 1 meter. Others think that's a very conservative estimate. We might get that much from Antarctic melting alone, plus what comes from the Arctic. Roland Warner, what do you think?
Yeah, this is a highly uncertain question, the contribution, particularly from Antarctica, but from the ice sheets in general, to global sea level rise. The IPCC is, as you say, coming up with numbers that are regarded as conservative. They also have to come up, of course, with what they think might happen under a whole range of scenarios. And because of the immense scrutiny that IPCC has, they do put a lot of effort into quantifying what they mean by being uncertain about something. And, you know, you can go and look in their tables, and if they say very likely, then that means such and such a probability percentage. But when it came to Antarctica, they finally had to give up on that. And while they said that only collapse of the so-called marine sectors of the Antarctic ice sheet, if initiated, could make sea level rise substantially above their likely range, the best they could do was say this additional contribution would not exceed several tenths of a meter during the 21st century. Now, that's a little bit of a lapse from the careful calibrated uncertainty in terms of, you know, several tenths of a meter covers everywhere from, you know, 20 centimeters to the best part of a meter. So this really is the most uncertain contribution to long-term sea level prediction. Things like the thermal expansion of the ocean, pretty well under control in terms of simulating that for various different climate warming scenarios. Mountain glaciers are also fairly hard to do, but at least there's an upper limit of the worst that can happen is they might eventually all be gone. You don't want to apply that sort of analysis to Antarctica or Greenland. It's not a useful worst-case scenario because it tells you something like 60 meters of sea level rise, which is certainly not going to happen anytime soon, but it's also not a useful end member.
Because really, it's so shocking, it would rearrange civilization altogether if we eventually get that much. But as you say, we're talking at least in centuries.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Don't forget our hot interview with prepper garden wizard Marjorie Wildcraft is still to come. This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Australian Antarctic expert Dr. Roland Warner. Another complication difficult for non-scientists, Dr. Warner, to understand is the prediction that snowfall on Antarctica may actually increase with climate change, and even that may help speed glacier movement to the sea. Can you talk to us about that, please?
Yes, I think we certainly expect that most of Antarctica is not yet receiving the sort of climate warming that's been so dramatic in the Antarctic Peninsula. And that may be partly due to slowly fading out effect from the seasonal ozone hole in Antarctica, which has tended to have an influence on Antarctic climate. But if the air temperature rises, it's still going to be very cold, but clearly warmer air can hold more moisture, and so everybody does expect that snowfall in Antarctica will increase. And I've seen the studies that suggest that that itself accelerates the flow to the ocean. I think that the increased melting of ice shelves is likely to be a far bigger effect in that. Some early studies that we did nearly 20 years ago showed that, you know, if you think it's going to take a 1,000 years to establish some new equilibrium, then whether you get 2 meters or 3 meters of sea level rise from Antarctica would depend on whether you had factored in this compensating effect of higher rates of snowfall in Antarctica. Because obviously, snowfall in Antarctica is really like putting sea level rise away in the bank, and it can take hundreds to thousands of years to flow back. So it's certainly an important compensating effect, but I think the dynamic response really driven by the ocean is going to be the biggest influence on Antarctic change.
Right. It's hard for people to understand that it's not that the warming air temperature is going to melt these things from above. It's that the hotter ocean reaching in is going to weaken them from below. Isn't that the story?
That's certainly what we're seeing, particularly because some of the areas that are changing the most drastically at the moment in the area of Antarctica below the Pacific Ocean, in the area called the Amundsen Sea, this is almost about as far south as you can actually sail a ship before you actually bump into Antarctica. And yet it's there, where the air temperatures are still well below freezing, that we're seeing these biggest changes. And it is one of the places where we know that the warm ocean currents that circulate normally at some distance around Antarctica do manage, by virtue of currents and the topography of the continental shelf, they do manage to come inshore there. And it certainly shows the power of ocean water. One shouldn't actually underestimate the effect of warmer air temperature, at least in the more northerly parts of Antarctica. Warm air temperature and summer melting on the surface of these ice shelves is actually certainly playing a big role in the rather dramatic disintegration over the matter of a few weeks of a few ice shelves in the Antarctic Peninsula back in the end of the last century.
Well, all along we've talked about West Antarctica and East Antarctica as though they are almost separate parts of the puzzle. Are there any generalizations you can give us about what is happening in these two halves compared to each other?
Yeah, it's interesting that in some ways they do fit being described as if they were two different worlds. The observational evidence we have for the loss of ice from Antarctica, because we can actually directly measure the disappearance of ice from space, either by seeing the change in the fall of the ice surface telling us that the ice is getting thinner and flowing off, or by actually weighing the ice sheet from space. We can tell that West Antarctica is where currently most of the action is. Overall in East Antarctica, very little change, maybe some slight overall increase, although this area around the Totten Glacier is one of the hot spots in East Antarctica. It's perhaps the place where there's most consistent ice loss going on there, which is one of the reasons that we're so interested. But so in terms of the current response, there seem to be two separate worlds. However, what we're realizing, as we discussed earlier, is in fact parts of East Antarctica, in terms of this very deep bedrock well below sea level and deep channels connecting that out towards the ocean, some of that is a lot more like West Antarctica in terms of its setting than people previously thought. It could well be that it's simply a matter of the response of the forcing, and perhaps in East Antarctica in the future we might see phenomena that we'll recognize from what we presently see in West Antarctica.
Dr. Warner, are we able to say whether in total Antarctica is losing mass, staying the same, or gaining ice mass?
Yeah, it's very clearly losing ice, and there's pretty good evidence that that rate of loss is accelerating. That comes from these direct observations that really, as I say, putting the ice sheet on the scales and saying, yeah, you're losing weight. So that loss in West Antarctica is outweighing slight increases or stability in East Antarctica. The experts think that in maybe another year of observations, we'll be in a better position to sort out the influencing that process of seasonal variations, if you like, particularly in snowfall. it's quite impressive that looking from space, you can actually see, this actually is very much easier to see in Greenland than in Antarctica, but you can actually see in Greenland the seasonal arrival of the big dumps of snow that come in the winter and the greater loss of ice over the summer. And there's actually that annual cycle quite visible. In Antarctica, things are not quite so clear because things are happening on a grander, slower scale. But people are convinced that, you know, collecting observations for longer will allow us to sort out trends without the confusion of seasonal variations.
Well, the key question with sea level rise is always when, and we discussed this a little bit, but do we have enough science yet to really know how much Antarctica will add to the world's oceans during this century?
No, we don't. It's actually the biggest unknown in trying to predict what sea level to expect. And in fact, the IPCC felt they couldn't even give you an opinion about how much the response might vary according to what sort of global warming track or trajectory we found ourselves on. So it's quite serious unknown. And the other thing about Antarctica is there is a lot of ice there. We've slightly touched upon the fact that the ice sheet is sitting on this well below sea level bedrock. One of the other complications is that in several areas, West Antarctica is the paradigm for this, I guess, the bedrock just gets deeper and deeper and deeper as you go towards the interior of the ice sheet. And so there is a possibility, and in fact it's titled the Marine Ice Sheet Instability, there is a prospect that if the grounding line is starting to move inland, it'll just keep on going and it'll continue to retreat and you'll continue to lose ice until you finally manage to have your ice sheet catch itself on some bedrock features and so on that stabilise that retreat process. So how much it'll give in this century is rather uncertain, and the prospect is that it could keep on giving, and it could keep on giving even if we stabilise the world in some warmer state.
Yes, I think NASA scientists came out and said that the process is unstoppable.
Yes, the recent analyses of what's happening in this Amundsen Sea region with a couple of the big glaciers there, like the Thwaites Glacier, is they feel they've done enough bedrock profiling there, again using this ice-penetrating radar system, to say they can't see any obvious new anchor points that would stop the retreat that has currently started. So when the IPCC said we might get more sea level rise, we can't really quantify it, if we start to initiate this marine ice sheet collapse, it's possible we're seeing the first stages in that already.
Please tell us about a couple of projects the Antarctic Climate and Ecosystems Cooperative Research Center has on the go.
Our activities range from voyages with the Australian icebreaker to the front of the Totten Glacier just this January, where they did actually verify the first time anybody's got this close to the calving front of the Totten ever. Pack ice just opened and the captain was brave enough to sail in there and get some measurements. And so we do know that the warm water is actually arriving there at the front of the cavity, and with this work that's just been published, led by Jamin Greenbaum from the University of Texas in Austin, we now think that we can see the channels by which that warm water is going to make its way under the ice. So the Totten remains a major interest for us. We've already been doing ocean circulation model studies to try and explore how the ocean circulation moves underneath ice shelves and also how the resulting meltwater affects the external ocean. And now that we've got an improved picture of what the space underneath the Totten looks like, we'll be going back to run those models there again. And the big step forward is to start coupling the dynamics of the ice shelves and the flow of the grounded ice behind with the ocean, because obviously if you're melting the bottom of the ice shelf, changing the geometry of that, that changes the world in which your ocean model is living. And so we need to couple those systems together eventually, and that'll become part of an entire sort of Earth system model. We'll be doing more survey work with our aerogeophysical surveys, exploring lots of places, the bedrock in Antarctica, you know, used to be the most poorly understood part of our whole planet. We know the bathymetry of the deep ocean a lot better than we know what's underneath part of Antarctica. So that work will be continuing. And we've also got field programs on the Amory Ice Shelf. This is East Antarctica's biggest ice shelf and Antarctica's third largest ice shelf. And we had a field program there with oceanographic instruments that were deployed by drilling through nearly 1,000 metres of ice shelf and deploying instruments in the ocean underneath in order to find out what's actually going on in these rather inaccessible parts of the planet.
You know, hearing you talk, it almost sounds like we're trying to discover some things about Mars. You know, it's a mile deep beneath the ice. It's very difficult to peer around. We don't know a lot of things. It's amazing that we're finding out as much as we do.
Yeah, it's when we started this ice cap survey from Casey Station, and I should say we go out 1,000 kilometres on and back on each flight there. That was an area where there were maybe two ground-based survey lines in the whole previous 50 years of Antarctic exploration, and we would gather that much data in an eight-hour flight. And so, yeah, we're slowly shading it in. There are still a few places which we hope to get to where, if you were a 15th century map maker, you'd probably be writing here be dragons, because we still don't have a detailed bedrock there. But at least the map is being filled in.
From Hobart, Tasmania, we've been talking with Dr. Roland C. Warner. He's a researcher with Australia's Antarctic Climate and Ecosystems Cooperative Research Centre. Dr. Roland, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. I really appreciate it.
No, it's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. We are back after the online Grow Your Own Food Summit with the organizer, Marjorie Wildcraft. Marjorie, remind us just once again where you grow your food and the way you operate your homestead experiments.
Hi, Alex. Yeah, I live in Central Texas, and my homestead is a research center dedicated to finding systems and developing systems for you to be able to grow half of your own food in a backyard-sized space in less than an hour a day. Pretty tall order, but we're working on it.
Last week, you talked about getting your husband and son on board with aquaponics. Is it necessary to have everybody in your family on board with this prepper gardening style right from the get-go?
No. In fact, I'd say that the vast majority of people who consider themselves preppers, they have a reluctant spouse or reluctant children, and so they just, you know, go and do what they do anyway. With growing your own food, what I would recommend is just get started, and the family actually starts to get involved in it. One of the best ways to get them on board is when you're harvesting. That's one of the most delightful times, especially with kids. I can give you some of the best vegetables to grow for kids that'll make them almost be out there in your yard treating it like a snack bar. You know those little cherry tomatoes that grow so well in the summertime? Those kids will be out there fighting for them. And in the cooler seasons, those sugar snap peas are delicious, or strawberries. You know, if you've got some really tasty food out there, those kids will be out there playing with it. And that's one way to get them involved with it without it even being a prepper thing, right?
Tell us about your aquaponics setup. What have you done there?
Yeah, we built one, and I believe it's like 30 feet long by about 12 feet wide, and it has a 150-gallon fish tank. And, you know, I had always initially avoided aquaponics because it's a little bit high-tech. You know, it's going to involve motors and pumps and things like that, which actually ended up being the attraction for my husband and my son. That's the reason they like it, is it's kind of high-tech. I've really been impressed with those systems. They do require energy, you know, so you're going to be needing some solar power or wind power or the electrical grid, which is another reason we had avoided it initially. We were initially always developing our systems for a grid down or ultimate sustainability type of situation. But we ended up going with this. I have to say that it is definitely easier to grow food in the aquaponic system. Our first year of experiments are that way. It does require a little bit more watching. For example, if that pump goes out, your fish only have so long before they're going to need oxygen and die. So it does need a little bit more monitoring like that. But on the other hand, it really is easier. And part of that here in Central Texas, it was protected from the wind. It was protected from extremes of heat and cold. You know, the plants just grew better. The fish created the waste that fed the plants, and it worked really well. It's a good system.
Yeah, it's kind of a self-enclosed system in a way, but it is tricky and technical, as you say. I've been avoiding it so far. Let's talk about permaculture. That's another major contender for truly sustainable agriculture. Have you experimented with a food forest? And by the way, what is a food forest?
Well, I love food forests, and I have to say this is my particular favorite way to grow food. The idea of a food forest is you create an area that mimics nature in that you plant trees and bushes and vines and herbal layers, and every plant in there is edible or medicinal or beneficial in some way. And if you look at a forest does not need any tending, right? You go to a pristine forest, and the trees there, they drop their leaves, they're self-mulching. You know, they've learned how to manage the water that comes to them naturally. They don't need to be irrigated. And they all, you know, there's still some production of food and animals and wildlife live in it. So what we try to do is create systems like that and mimic it and try to maybe have it slanted with a little bit more benefit toward us. They're more investment in time getting up and started because a lot of your fruit and nut trees are not going to start producing for 5 to 10 years. But once you get them established, they are much, much less work than annual gardens.
We all know gardening can help seniors maintain their mental and physical health much longer, but eventually we may not be able to handle the heavy work. How can we set up a garden to keep going with very little effort?
Well, that's it exactly. That's why food forests are it's a real retirement plan, unlike Social Security, which we never really know if that's how long that's going to be around, right? So a real retirement plan is going to be to plant a food forest or to plant a small orchard right now, while you've got the strength and energy to have that going. And then, you know, in your later years, it's a lot easier to just harvest apples than it is to be planting, doing all the work of the annual garden.
Let's talk about prepping for pests. I built 2 big raised beds out of some used lumber, but I put a wire lining on the bottom to keep out the moles that seem to love my rich garden soil. What else can we do to encourage pests to stay out of the garden?
Well, one thing is to have just to have really good, rich soil will help reduce your insect problems. For moles and gophers, personally, I have a big problem with that. We have a lot of sand here, and I've been experimenting with using castor beans as a mole repellent and a gopher repellent, and so far it seems to be working very well. In fact, castor used to be known as the no-gopher plant. One of the realities of having a beautiful food source like that is you are going to need to have some fencing or some protection from everything else that loves to eat your food, like raccoons or squirrels or rabbits. So a good fence around your garden is just a reality.
Well, ours is about 7 feet high, and then we dangle little pieces of cloth and colored foil on the top of that to keep the deer from jumping in. But for the rest, we always plant a little extra for all the creatures that are going to eat out of your garden, whether you like it or not.
That's a very good practice. We rely very heavily on 2 dogs to do a large part of the protection from the predators here. In fact, one of the dogs is even really good at spotting overhead aerial hawks and barking and letting everybody know when the hawks are nearby. And I find them invaluable. They work all night. They mostly sleep all day. I don't feed them very much because I give them the butchering scraps from when we do butchering, and then they also just get whatever table scraps we don't eat, and then they find what they can. You know, they'll dig up gophers or catch a rabbit here and there. So they don't really require a lot of input, and they do a lot of work.
When I was doing part-time farming in eastern Canada, the only chemical I used was rotenone. It's made from ground-up roots of a South American plant, and Robert Rodale used it. I had to use it for the Colorado potato beetle. If you have a big planting of potatoes, we had a couple of acres. There's no way to squash all those bugs by hand. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a lot of work to manage a couple of acres of potatoes. You know, we all need to use as much organic processes as possible. The classic thing with something like a couple of acres of potatoes is to pay the kids. It used to be a penny a bug, and you'd have them go through the rows, and then they'd dump out their bugs, and you'd count them, and you'd pay them. That used to be the way to get rid of the Colorado potato beetle.
Could still work today if you get some neighborhood kids going. Well, last week you talked about not needing refrigeration or freezers, that we could just munch our way through the fresh food season. But I have to admit, there are times when we got so much food, more than we could give away or trade even, that we needed to freeze some, at least until we could catch up to our canning and drying. I like canning and dehydration because they don't depend on the grid staying up. What about you?
I do too. I'm a huge proponent of that. And fermentation also as another method of food storage. By the way, at the Homegrown Food Summit, we have one presentation by Kendra Lynn, who will be showing you how to do water bath canning and how to do pressure canning. And what I love about it is, you know, some people have a fear of those big pressure canners because they are these big, intimidating things, and there's these stories of them blowing up and stuff, right? There's no longer a concern about it. They've built them. They're now safe. But when you see Kendra, who's this slight and beautiful woman, just handling that machinery, you'll go, oh, I can do it. And we also have Wardy Harmon, who's going to be doing a whole thing on how to preserve food by fermentation, as well as the health benefits. It turns out that fermented foods really help your gut bacteria and help you to digest a lot better. So some of these techniques are actually can help increase the nutrition content of the food you're eating.
Yeah, Wardy's a real gem. We've had her on Radio EcoShock, and I still check out her blog once a week, and it's important to keep up with that. One of my goals is to build a solar dryer. Do you have one?
We do. I used a model based on, I believe it's Appalachian State University created this model. There's lots of other ones out there, and it has worked really, really well. Now, we do tend to be a bit drier here in Texas, but I found that that model even worked well during the summers when or the times when we've had a wet period. That is definitely a technique for preserving food that's very useful.
Farmers around here used to throw their peaches up on a hot tin roof on one of their sheds and solar dried them that way, and it did work. Now, let me ask you, do you let chickens into your garden?
On rare occasions, I do. One example was one time my sweet potatoes showed up with these strange-looking little beetles that had a shiny, it was almost looked like chrome shell. I have no idea what they were. They were little alien beetles. You know, normally when I see an insect outbreak like that, I think immediately that my plants are stressed and they need some nutrient, you know, some sort of nutrient thing, and I'll try to get them, you know, a liquid seaweed or some homemade compost or something. But in the short-term immediate, what I do is I let the chickens in there. And chickens are naturally insectivores. They love insects first. But I watch them, and as soon as they're done getting all the insects, then you want to kick them out of the garden because then they'll start scratching up the rest of your plants.
They do. They will scratch them up. So I'll bet after all your YouTube videos and your best-selling Grow Your Own Groceries course that you hear from gardeners all over the world, do you?
We do, and we have a very active network of people that contribute things that they're discovering and that they're learning, and we're very excited about that and want to develop that further. We're actually creating also a network of places just like our place where we're doing research on different ways to grow food. Other places that are doing that are starting to become networked together, and we're sharing results and making it available to everybody. Really, I feel, Alex, this solution is going to come from you and from me and from, you know, I mean, anybody even, I'll tell you an example of Leslie. Leslie Parsons still works full time, and she only has a small garden. She's very passionate about squash. She's got about a 200 square foot garden, and so she's been doing all these experiments with squash, and she's come up with a couple of varieties that are resistant to the squash vine borer, which is a horrible problem for people, and squash is such a good, important calorie crop. So even though she's only doing this part-time in a 200-square-foot garden, she has done really, really valuable research on a crop that's resistant to the squash vine borer, which is hugely important to the rest of us. She's publishing that work on our blog and making it available to other people and creating a whole discussion about it. Now other people are trying it and duplicating her work and getting feedback to her. This is how it's going to happen. Monsanto is not here to help us. The USDA is not here to help us. Unfortunately, our own government, while it does try, it's actually still really controlled by the big companies. This is going to be a problem that can only be solved by you and me and by individuals and neighbors working together. And that's the whole reason for what I do, is working at this grassroots level of coming up with real solutions for you to create your own food and medicine.
Well, I want to take your DVD course. What's in it and what does it cost?
Well, the video said it's two DVDs, and then it includes a CD-ROM that's a whole library of documents to support it. And what it's basically like is me taking you by the hand and taking you through my homestead here and showing you how I grow food. And I'm like, here's the water tanks we set up to catch rainwater, and oh, by the way, we overbuilt it. It was a huge mistake. Please don't make it this big. And then here's a place where we started a garden, and here's another place we started a garden, and these are the reasons why those gardens totally sucked and failed, but here's where we've put our other garden, and this is working, and here's the gardening method that I use because this is the most efficient one, and I've tried all these other ones, but this is the one that I really like. And here's where I keep the rabbits, and I put them right here next to the garden because that way their fertility can help me, and it's real simple and easy to do this way. And here's my flock of chickens, and here's the reason I have them like this, and here's the dogs, and oh, look, this is the size fence you really need to keep this out of the garden, right? And here's my orchard, and here's all the experiments with the trees we've done, and this is why these have died, and these have lived, and, you know, I just take you and show you everything that I go through, and even the butchering process. Here's how you butcher a rabbit, and here's how you butcher a chicken. And here's what you do with all the parts of those animals. That's it. It's really, two video set that shows you all those components. And then, again, that library, the resource library. So, you know, I talk about a rainwater collection system. We have a whole rainwater collection system ebook in there on how to build one. Or I talk about, you know, butchering a rabbit, and then we have a whole article on how to tan a rabbit hide so that way you'll be able to use those effectively. Or, you know, we've got 5 different PDFs on different ways to compost because fertility is so important. So that's what it's all about. It's at growyourowngroceries.com, and it's $37 for the full set. But I'll tell you what, I'd really recommend you go to the Homegrown Food Summit and watch that presentation I have on how to grow half of your own food in your backyard in less than an hour a day. Take a look at that and say, you know, that'll really inspire you that you could do this. You could get those systems up and running in about 6 months and be producing half of your own food in less than an hour a day by next year.
I'd love to do it. Now, Marjorie, what will your next project be, or is it too soon to tell?
Well, we've got a lot of irons in the fire, and after this summit, we're going to look at what will have the most impact to be able to have more homegrown food on every table. We're looking at doing some stuff in partnership with Mike Adams of the Natural News and possibly working on some developing some programs to get local food into schools. We've got a whole, also developing that network of research organizations. There's a lot on the table. We haven't yet figured that out.
We've been talking with Marjorie Wildcraft of GrowYourOwnGroceries.com. Her DVD guide to growing in your own backyard is a bestseller. Her free YouTube videos on growing your own food are really popular. And Marjorie recently organized the biggest online summit dedicated to growing homegrown food. I'll be putting links to all of that in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Marjorie, thank you so much for helping all of us out.
Alex, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Find all our past programs as MP3 downloads at our website, ecoshock.org. Don't forget to follow up on links for this week's show in my weekly blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.info, or listen to the SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/radioecoshock. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and I hope we will get together again next week as we talk with Robert Scribler.